swiftly flung insults, Helene's gaze slides to me repeatedly. She knows I don't frequent the docks. I avoid her eyes. She wants an explanation. But where would I even begin? Well, you see, Hel, I wanted to desert today, but this damn auger showed up, and now... When we arrive at the armory, students spill out the front doors, and Faris and Dex disappear into the crush. I've never seen the senior skulls so... happy. With liberation just a few minutes away, everyone is smiling. Skulls I barely ever speak to greet me, clap me on the back, joke with me. Elias! Helene! Leander, his nose crooked from the time Helene broke it, calls us over. Demetrius stands beside him, grim as always. I wonder if he feels any joy today. Maybe he's just relieved to leave the place where he watched his brother die. When he sees Helene, Leander self-consciously runs his hand over his curly hair, which sticks up all over the place, no matter how short he cuts it. I try not to smile. He's liked her for ages, though he pretends not to.
Armorer already called your names.
Leander nods to two stacks of armor and weaponry behind him.
We grabbed your ceremonials for you.
Helene goes for hers like a jewel thief for rubies, holding the bracers to the light, exclaiming how Blackcliff's diamond symbol is seamlessly hammered into the shield. The close-fitting armor is forged by the Teluman smithy, one of the oldest in the Empire, and is strong enough to turn away all but the finest blades. Blackcliff's final gift to us. Once the armor is on, I strap on my weaponry. Sims and daggers of Ceric steel, razor-sharp and graceful, especially compared to the dull, utilitarian weapons we've used until now. The last piece is a black cape held in place by a chain. When I'm done, I look up to see Helene staring at me. What? I say. Her expression is so intent that I glance down, assuming I've put my chest plate on backward. But everything is where it should be. When I look back up, she's standing before me, adjusting my cape, her long fingers brushing my neck.
It wasn't straight.
She dons her helmet.
How do I look?
If the augurs made my armor to accentuate my body's power, they made Hel's to accentuate her beauty.
You look...
like a warrior goddess. Like a genie of air come to bring us all to our knees.
Skies, what the hell is wrong with me?
Like a mask, I say. She laughs, girlish and preposterously alluring, drawing the attention of other students. Leander, who jerks his gaze away and rubs his crooked nose guiltily when I catch him looking. Faris, who grins and mutters something to an appraising Dex. Across the room, Zack stares too. The expression on his face, something between longing and puzzlement. Then I see Marcus beside Zack, watching his brother as his brother watches Hel.
Look, boys, Marcus says. A bitch in armor.
My sim is half drawn when Hel puts a hand on my arm, her eyes flashing fire at me. My fight, not yours.
Go to Hel, Marcus.
Helene finds her cape a few feet away and dons it. The snake ambles over, his eyes creeping down her body, leaving no doubt as to what he's thinking.
Armor doesn't suit you, Aquila, he says. I'd prefer you in a dress, or nothing at all.
He lifts a hand to her hair, wrapping a loose tendril gently around his finger, before yanking it hard, pulling her face toward his. It takes me a second to recognize the snarl that splits the air as my own. I'm a foot from Marcus, my fists hungry for his flesh, when two of his toadies, Thaddeus and Julius, grab me from behind, wrenching my arms back. Demetrius is beside me in a second, his sharp elbow jutting into Thaddeus's face, but Julius aims a kick at Demetrius's back, and he goes down. Then, in a flash of silver, Helene's holding one knife to Marcus's neck and the other to his groin.
"Let go of my hair," she says, "or I'll relieve you of your manhood."
Marcus releases the ice-blonde curl and whispers something in Helene's ear. And just like that, her confident air dissolves. The knife at Marcus's throat falters, and he grabs her face in his hands and kisses her. I'm so disgusted that for a moment all I can do is gape and try not to vomit. Then a muffled scream erupts from Helene, and I tear my arms from Thaddeus and Julius. In a second, I'm past them both, shoving Marcus away from Helene, landing blow after satisfying blow on his face. Between my punches, Marcus is laughing, and Helene is wiping at her mouth frenziedly. Leander pulls at my shoulders, rapidly demanding a turn at the snake. Behind me, Demetrius is back on his feet, trading punches with Julius, who overpowers him, shoving his pale head to the ground. Varys comes hurtling out of the crowd, his giant body thudding into Julius and knocking him down, a ball ramming through a fence. I spot Tristus's tattoo and Dex's dark skin, and all hell breaks loose. Then someone hisses, "Commandant!" Varys and Julius lurch to their feet. I shove away from Marcus, and Helene stops clawing at her face. The snake staggers up slowly, his eyes darkening into twin pools of bruise. My mother cuts through the skulls, coming straight for Helene and me.
"Vittorius! Aquila!"
She spits our names like fruit gone bad.
"Explain."
"No explanation, Commandant, sir,"
Helene and I say at the same time. I look past her, into the distance as I've been trained to, and her cold glare bores into me with the delicacy of a blunt knife. From his spot behind the Commandant, Marcus smirks, and I clench my jaw. If Helene is whipped because of his depravity, I'll hold off on deserting just so I can kill him.
"Eighth bell is minutes away."
The Commandant turns her gaze to the rest of the armory.
"You will compose yourselves and report to the amphitheater. Any more incidents like this, and those involved will be shipped to Koff forthwith. Understood?"
"Yes, sir."
The skulls file out quietly. As fivers, we all did 6 months guard duty at Koff Prison, far to the north. None of us would risk being sent there for something as stupid as a graduation day brawl.
"Are you all right?"
I ask Hel when the Commandant's out of earshot.
"I want to rip my face off and replace it with one that's never been touched by that swine."
"You need someone else to kiss you, is all," I say, before realizing how that sounds.
Not that I'm volunteering. I mean..."
"Yeah, I got it."
Helene rolls her eyes. Her jaw goes tight, and I wish I'd kept my mouth shut about the kissing.
"Thanks, by the way," she says, "for punching him."
I'd have killed him if the Commandant hadn't shown up. Her eyes are warm when she looks at me, and I'm about to ask her what Marcus whispered in her ear when Zack passes us. He fiddles with his brown hair and slows, as if he wants to say something. But I look at him with murder in my eyes, and after a few seconds, he turns away. Minutes later, Helene and I join the senior skulls lining up outside the amphitheater's entrance, and the armory brawl is forgotten. We march into the amphitheater to the applause of family, students, city officials, the Emperor's emissaries, and an honor guard of nearly 200 legionnaires. I meet Helene's eyes and see my own astonishment mirrored there. It is surreal to be here on the field instead of watching enviously from the stands. The sky above burns brilliant and clean without a single cloud from horizon to horizon. Flags festoon the theater's heights, the red and gold pennant of Jen's Tyre snapping in the wind beside the black, diamond-emblazoned standard of Blackcliff. My grandfather, General Quinn Veturius, head of Gens Veturia, sits in a shaded box in the front row. About 50 of his closest relatives, brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, are arrayed around him. I don't have to see his eyes to know he's taking my measure, checking the angle of my sim, scrutinizing the fit of my armor. After I was chosen for Blackcliff, Grandfather took one look at my eyes and recognized his daughter in them. He brought me into his home when Mother refused to bring me into hers. No doubt she was enraged that I had survived when she assumed she was rid of me. I spent every leave training with Grandfather, enduring beatings and harsh discipline, but gaining, in return, a distinct edge over my classmates. He knew I would need that edge. Few of Blackcliff's students have uncertain parentage, and none had ever been raised among the tribes. Both facts made me an object of curiosity and ridicule. But if anyone dared treat me poorly because of my background, Grandfather put them in their place, usually with the point of his sword, and quickly taught me to do the same. He can be as heartless as his daughter, but he's the only relative I have who treats me like family. Though it's not regulation, I lift my hand in salute as I pass him, gratified when he nods in return. After a series of formation drills, the graduates march to the wooden benches at the center of the field and draw sims, holding them high. A low rumble starts up, growing until it sounds like a thunderstorm has been unleashed in the amphitheater. It's the other Blackcliff students, pounding on their stone seats and roaring with a mix of pride and envy. Beside me, Helene and Leander both fail to suppress grins. Amid the noise, silence descends in my head. It's a strange silence, infinitely small, infinitely large, and I'm locked inside it, pacing, circling the question. Do I run? Do I desert? Far away, like a voice heard underwater, the Commandant orders us to return sims and sit. She delivers a terse speech from a raised dais, and when it comes time to take our oaths to the Empire, I only know to stand because everyone around me does. Stay or run? I ask myself. Stay or run? I think my mouth moves along with everyone else's as they vow their blood and bodies to the Empire. The Commandant graduates us, and the cheer that erupts out of the new masks, raw and relieved, is what wrenches me from my thoughts. Varys rips off his school tags and throws them into the sky, followed by the rest of us. They fly into the air, catching the sun like a flock of silver birds. Families chant their graduates' names. Helene's parents and sisters call out, Aquila! Varys's family calls out, Candelan! I hear, Vissen! Tullius! Galerius! And then I hear a voice rising above all the rest. Veturius! Veturius! Grandfather stands in his box, backed by the rest of the family, reminding everyone here that one of the Empire's most powerful gens has seen a son graduate today. I find his eyes, and for once, there's no criticism there, only a fierce pride. He grins at me, wolfish and white against the silver of his mask, and I find myself smiling back, before confusion floods me and I look away. He won't be smiling if I desert.
Elias!
Helene throws her arms around me, eyes shining.
We did it! We...
We spot the augurs in the same moment, and her arms fall away. I've never seen all 14 at once, and my stomach dips. Why are they here? Their hoods are thrown back, revealing their unsettlingly stark features, and, led by Kane, they ghost across the grass and form a half-circle around the Commandant's dais. The cheers of the audience fade into a questioning hum. My mother watches, her hand idle on her sim-hilt. When Kane mounts the dais, She steps aside as if she expected him. Cain raises his hand for silence, and in seconds the crowd goes mute. From where I sit on the field, he's a bizarre spectre, so frail and ashen. But when he speaks, his voice rings out across the amphitheater with a force that makes everyone sit up.
From among the battle-hardened youth, there shall rise the foretold, he says. The greatest emperor, scourge of our enemies, commander of a host most devastating, and the empire shall be made whole. So the augurs foretold 500 years ago, as we drew the stones of this school from the shuddering earth. And so the foretelling shall come to pass. The line of Emperor Tyus 21st will fail.
A near mutinous buzz rolls through the crowd. If anyone but an augur had questioned the Emperor's line, he'd have already been struck down. The legionnaires of the Honor Guard bristle, hands on their weapons. But at one look from Cain, they settle back, a pack of barely cowed dogs.
Tyus 21st shall have no direct male issue, Cain says. Upon his death, the empire will fall unless a new warrior emperor is chosen. Tyus the First, father of our empire, and Pater of Gens-Tyre, was the finest fighter of his time. He was tested, tempered, and tried before he was deemed fit to rule. The people of the Empire expect no less of their new leader.
Bleeding, burning skies.
Behind me, Tristus elbows an open-mouthed Dex triumphantly. We all know what Cain will say next, but I still don't believe what I'm hearing.
Thus, the time for the trials has come.
The amphitheater explodes, or at least it sounds like it's exploded, because I've never heard anything so loud. Tristus bellows,
I told you!
At Dex, who looks as if someone smashed him over the head with a hammer. Leander shouts,
Who? Who?
Marcus laughs, a smug cackle that makes me yearn to stab him. Helene has a hand clapped over her mouth, her eyes comically wide as she grasps for words. Cain's hand comes up again, and again the crowd falls deathly silent.
The trials are upon us, he says. To ensure the future of the Empire, the new emperor must be at the peak of his strength, as Tyus was when he took the throne. Thus do we turn to our battle-hardened youth, our newest masks. But not all shall vie for this great honor. Only the greatest of our graduates are worthy, the strongest. Only four. Of these four aspirants, one will be named the Foretold. One will swear fealty and serve as the Bloodshrike. The others will be lost as leaves on the wind. This, too, we have seen.
My blood begins to pound in my ears.
Elias Veturius, Marcus Farrar, Helene Aquila, Zacharias Farrar.
He calls our names in the order we're ranked.
Rise and come forward.
The amphitheater is dead quiet. Numbly, I stand, shutting out the searching looks of my classmates, the glee on Marcus's face, the indecision on Zach's. The field of battle is my temple. The sword point is my priest. Helene's back is ramrod straight, but she looks to me, to Cain, to the commandant. At first, I think she's frightened. Then I notice the shine in her eyes, the spring in her step. When Hel and I were fivers, A barbarian raiding party took us prisoner. I was trussed like a festival day goat, but they tied Helene's hands in front of her with twine and propped her on the back of a pony, assuming she was harmless. That night, she used the twine to garrote three of our jailers and broke the necks of the other three with her bare hands.
"They always underestimate me,"
she said afterward, sounding puzzled. She was right, of course. It's a mistake even I make. Hell's not frightened, I realize. She's euphoric. She wants this. The walk to the stage takes too little time. In seconds, I'm standing in front of Kane with the others.
"To be chosen as an aspirant for the trials is to be granted the greatest honor the Empire has to offer."
Kane looks at each one of us, but it seems like his gaze lingers longest on me.
"In exchange for this great gift, the augurs require an oath. That as aspirants, you will see the trials through until the Emperor is named. The penalty for breaking this oath is death." "You must not undertake this oath lightly," Kane says. "If you wish, you may turn and leave this podium. You will remain a mask, with all the respect and honor accorded to those of that title. Another will be chosen in your place. It is, in the end, your choice."
Your choice. Those two words shake me to my marrow.
"Tomorrow you will have to make a choice. Between deserting and doing your duty. Between running from your destiny and facing it."
Kane doesn't mean doing my duty as a mask. He wants me to choose between taking the trials and deserting.
"You devious red-eyed devil.
I want to be free of the Empire, but how can I find freedom if I take the trials? If I win and become Emperor, I'll be tied to the Empire for life. And if I swear fealty, I'll be changed to the Emperor as the second in command, the Bloodshrike. Or I'll be a leaf lost in the wind, which is just a fancy augur way of saying dead."
"Reject him, Elias. Run. By this time tomorrow, you'll be miles away."
Kane watches Marcus, and the augur's head is tilted as if he's listening to something beyond our ken.
"Marcus Farrar, you are ready."
It's not a question. Marcus kneels and draws his sword, offering it up to the augur, his eyes glinting with a strangely exultant zeal, as if he's already been named emperor.
"Repeat after me," Kane says. "I, Marcus Farrar, swear by blood and by bone, by my honor and the honor of Jens Farrar, that I will dedicate myself to the trials, that I will see them through until the Emperor is named, or my body lies cold."
Marcus repeats the vow, his voice echoing in the breathless silence of the amphitheater. Kane closes Marcus's hands over his blade, pressing until blood drips from his palms. A moment later, Helene kneels, offering her sword, repeating the vow, her voice singing out across the field as clearly as a bell at dawn. The augur turns to Zack, who looks at his brother for a long moment before nodding and taking the oath. Suddenly, I'm the only one of the four aspirants still standing, and Kane is before me, awaiting my decision. Like Zack, I hesitate. Kane's words come back to me.
"You are woven through our dreams, a thread of silver in a tapestry of night."
Is becoming emperor my destiny then? How can such a destiny lead to freedom? I have no desire to rule. The very idea of doing so is repellent to me. But then my future as a deserter is no more appealing.
"You will become everything you hate. Evil, merciless, cruel.
Do I trust Cain when he says I will find freedom if I take the trials? At Blackliff, we learn to classify people. Civilian, combatant, enemy, ally, informer, defector. Based on that, we decide our next steps. But I have no understanding of the Augur. I don't know his motivations, his desires. The only thing I have is my instinct, which tells me that in this matter, at least, Cain wasn't lying. Whether his prediction is true or not, he trusts that it is. And since my gut tells me to trust him, albeit grudgingly, there's only one decision that makes sense. My eyes never leaving Cain's, I drop to my knees, draw my sword, and run the blade across my palm. My blood falls to the dais in a rapid drip. I, Elias Vittorius, swear, by blood and by bone.
Chapter 11. Liar. The Commandant of Blackliff Military Academy. My curiosity for the spy mission withers. The Empire trains the masks at Blackliff. Masks like the one who murdered my family and stole my brother. The school sprawls atop Sarah's eastern cliffs like a colossal vulture, a jumble of austere buildings enclosed by a black granite wall. No one knows what happens behind that wall, how the masks train, how many there are, how they are chosen. Every year, a new class of masks leaves Blackliff, young, savage, and deadly. For a scholar, especially a girl, Blackliff is the most dangerous place in the city. Mazin goes on.
She lost a personal slave. The girl threw herself off the cliffs a week ago, Keenan retorts, defying Mazin's glare. She's the third slave to die in the Commandant's service this year. Quiet, Mazin says. I won't lie to you, liar. The woman's unpleasant. She's insane, Keenan says. They call her the Bitch of Blackliff. You won't survive the Commandant. The mission will fail.
Mazin's fist comes down on the table. Keenan doesn't flinch.
If you can't keep your mouth shut, the resistance leader growls, then leave.
Tarek's jaw drops as he looks between the two men. Sana, meanwhile, watches Keenan with a thoughtful expression. Others in the cabin stare too, and I get the feeling that Keenan and Mazin don't disagree very often. Keenan scrapes his chair back and leaves the table, disappearing into the muttering crowd behind Mazin.
You're perfect for the job, liar, Mazin says. You have all the skills the Commandant would expect from a house slave. She'll assume you're illiterate, and we have the means to get you in.
What happens if I'm caught?
You're dead.
Mazin looks me straight in the eye, and I feel a bitter appreciation for his honesty.
Every spy we've sent to Blackliff has been discovered and killed. This isn't a mission for the faint-hearted.
I almost want to laugh. He couldn't have picked a worse person for it. You're not doing a very good job selling it.
I don't have to sell it, Mazin says. We can find your brother and break him out. You can be our eyes and ears in Blackliff. A simple exchange.
You trust me to do this? I ask. You hardly know me.
I knew your parents. That's enough for me. Mazin, Tarek speaks up. She's just a girl. Surely we don't need to... She invoked Izzat, Mazin says. But Izzat means more than freedom. It means more than honor. It means courage. It means proving yourself.
He's right, I say. If the resistance is going to help me, I can't have the fighters thinking I'm weak. A glimmer of red catches my eye, and I look across the cabin to where Keenan leans against a bunk watching me, his hair like fire in the torchlight. He doesn't want me to take this mission because he doesn't want to risk the men to save Darin. I put a hand to my armlet. Be brave, Lyra. I turned to Mazin.
If I do this, you'll find Darin. You'll break him out of jail.
You have my word. It won't be hard to locate him. He's not a resistance leader, so it's not as if they'll send him to Koff.
Mazin snorts, but mention of the infamous northern prison sends a chill across my skin. Koff's interrogators have one goal: to make inmates suffer as much as possible before they die. My parents died in Koff. My sister, only 12 at the time, died there too.
By the time you make your first report, Mazin says, I'll be able to tell you where Darin is. When your mission is complete, we'll break him out.
And after?
We pry your slave's cuffs off and pull you out of the school. We can make it look like a suicide, so you're not hunted. You can join us if you like. Or we can arrange passage to Marin for you both.
Marin? The Free Lands. What I wouldn't give to escape there with my brother, to live in a place with no marshals, no masks, no empire. But first, I have to survive a spy mission. I have to survive Blackcliff. Across the cavern, Keenan shakes his head, but the fighters around me nod. This is Izzat, they seem to say. I fall silent, as if considering. But my decision is made the second I realize that going to Blackcliff is the only way to get Darin back. I'll do it.
Good.
Mazin doesn't sound surprised, and I wonder if he knew all along that I would say yes. He raises his voice so it carries.
Keenan will be your handler.
At this, the younger man's face goes, if possible, even darker. He presses his lips together as if to keep from speaking.
Her hands and feet are cut up, Mazin says. See to her injuries, Keenan, and tell her what she needs to know. She leaves for Blackcliff tonight.
Mazin leaves, trailed by members of his faction, while Tarik claps me on the shoulder and wishes me luck. His allies pepper me with advice. Never go looking for your handler. Don't trust anyone. They only wish to help, but it's overwhelming, and when Keenan cuts through the crowd to retrieve me, I'm almost relieved. Almost. He jerks his head to a table in the corner of the cavern and walks off without waiting for me. A glint of light near the table turns out to be a small spring. Keenan fills two tubs with water and a powder I recognize as tanroot. He sets one tub on the table and one on the floor. I scrub my hands and feet clean, wincing as the tanroot sinks into the scrapes I picked up in the catacombs. Keenan watches silently. Beneath his scrutiny, I am ashamed at how quickly the water turns black with muck, and then angry at myself for being ashamed. When I'm done, Keenan sits at the table across from me and takes my hands. I'm expecting him to be brusque, but his hands are not gentle exactly, but not callous either. As he examines my cuts, I think of a dozen questions I could ask him, none of which will make him think that I'm strong and capable instead of childish and petty. Why do you seem to hate me? What did I do to you?
You shouldn't be doing this.
He rubs a numbing ointment on one of the deeper cuts, keeping his attention fixed on my wounds.
This mission.
You've made that clear, you jackass. I won't let Mazin down. I'll do what I have to.
You'll try, I'm sure.
I'm stung at his bluntness, though by now it should be clear that he has no faith in me.
The woman's a savage. The last person we sent in.
Do you think I want to spy on her? I burst out. He looks up, surprise in his eyes. I don't have a choice. Not if I want to save the only family I have left, so just... Shut it, I want to say. Just don't make this harder. Something like embarrassment crosses his face, and he regards me with a tiny bit less scorn. I'm...
Sorry.
His words are reluctant, but a reluctant apology is better than none at all. I nod jerkily and realize that his eyes are not blue or green, but a deep chestnut brown. You're noticing his eyes, Lyra, which means you're staring into them, which means you need to stop. The smell of the salve stings my nostrils and I wrinkle my nose. Are you using twin thistle in this salve? I ask. At his shrug, I pull the bottle from him and take another sniff. Try zebery next time. It doesn't smell like goat dung, at least. Keenan raises a fiery eyebrow and wraps one of my hands with gauze.
You know your remedies. Useful skill. Your grandparents were healers.
My grandfather? It hurts to speak of Pop, and I pause a long while before going on. He started training me formally 1.5 years ago. I mixed his remedies before that.
Do you like it? Healing?
It's a trade. Most scholars who aren't enslaved work menial jobs, as farmhands or cleaners or stevedores. Back-breaking labor for which they're paid next to nothing. I'm lucky to have one, though when I was little, I wanted to be a Kihani. Keenan's mouth curves into the barest smile. It is a small thing, but it transforms his entire face and lightens the weight on my chest.
A tribal tale spinner, he says. Don't tell me you believe in myths of djinn and ifrits and wraiths that kidnap children in the night.
No, I think of the raid, of the mask. My lightness melts away. I don't need to believe in the supernatural. Not when there's worse that roams the night. He goes still, a sudden stillness that draws my eyes up and into his. My breath hitches at what I see laid bare in his gaze. A wrenching knowledge. A bitter understanding of pain that I know well. He's someone who has walked paths as dark as mine. Darker, maybe. Then coldness descends over his face, and his hands are moving again.
Right, he says. Listen carefully. Today was graduation day at Blackcliff, but we've just learned that this year's ceremony was different. Special.
He tells me of the trials and the 4 aspirants. Then he gives me my mission.
We need 3 pieces of information. We need to know what each trial is, where it's taken place, and when. And we need to know this before each trial begins, not after.
I have 12 questions, but I don't ask, knowing he'll just think me more foolish. How long will I be in the school?
Keenan shrugs and finishes bandaging my hands. We know next to nothing about the trials, he says, but I can't imagine it will take more than 1 week. 1 month, at most.
Do you think Darren will last that long?
Keenan doesn't answer.
Hours later in the early evening, I find myself in a house in the foreign quarter with Keenan and Sana standing before an elderly tribesman. He's clad in the loose robes of his people and looks more like a kindly old uncle than a resistance operative. When Sana explains what she wants of him, he takes one look at me and folds his arms across his chest.
Absolutely not, he says in heavily accented Saren. The Commandant will eat her alive.
Keenan throws Sana a pointed look as if to say, what did you expect? With respect, Sana says to the tribesman. Can we... She gestures to a lattice screen doorway leading to another room. They disappear behind the lattice. Sana's speaking too softly for me to hear, but whatever she's saying must not be working, because even through the screen, I can see the tribesman shaking his head. He won't do it, I say. Beside me, Keenan leans against the wall, unconcerned.
Sana can convince him. She's not leader of her faction for nothing.
I wish I could do something.
Try looking a little braver.
What? Like you? I arrange my face so it's blank as slate, slump against the wall, and look off into the distance. Keenan actually smiles for a fraction of a second. It takes years off his face. I rub a bare foot across the hypnotic swirls of the thick tribal rug on the floor. Pillows embroidered with tiny mirrors are strewn across it, and lamps of colored glass hang from the roof, catching the last rays of sunlight. Darren and I came to a house like this to sell Nan's jams once. I reach up to touch one of the lamps. I asked him why tribesmen have mirrors everywhere, and he said, "The memory is clear and sharp in my mind, and an ache for my brother, for my grandparents, pulses in my chest with such violence that I clamp my mouth shut. Tribesmen think the mirrors ward off evil," Darren said that day. He took out his sketchbook while we waited for the tribal trader and started drawing, capturing the intricacy of the lattice screens and lanterns with small, quick strokes of charcoal. Jin and Wraiths can't stand the sight of themselves, apparently. After that, he'd answered a dozen more of my questions with his usual quiet confidence. At the time, I'd wondered how he knew so much. Only now do I understand. Darren always listened more than he spoke, watching, learning. In that way, he was like Pop. The ache in my chest expands, and my eyes are suddenly hot. "It'll get better," Keenan says. I look up to see sadness flicker across his face, almost instantly replaced by that now familiar chill. "You'll never forget them, not even after years. But one day, you'll go a whole minute without feeling the pain. Then an hour, a day. That's all you can ask for, really." His voice drops. "You'll heal. I promise." He looks away, distant again. But I'm grateful to him anyway, because for the first time since the raid, I feel less alone. A second later, Sana and the tribesmen come around the screen.
"You're sure this is what you want?" the tribesman asks me.
I nod, not trusting my voice.
He sighs. "Very well."
He turns to Sana and Keenan.
"Say your goodbyes. If I take her now, I can still get her into the school by dark."
"You'll be all right." Sana hugs me tightly, and I wonder if she's trying to convince me or herself. "You're the lioness's daughter, and the lioness was a survivor." Until she wasn't. I lower my gaze so Sana doesn't see my doubt. She heads out the door, and then Keenan is before me. I cross my arms, not wanting him to think I need a hug from him too. But he doesn't touch me, just cocks his head and lifts his fist to his heart. The resistance salute.
"Death before tyranny," he says.
Then he, too, is gone. A half hour later, dusk drops over the city of Serra, and I am following the tribesmen swiftly through the Mercator Quarter, home to the wealthiest members of the martial merchant class. We stop before the ornate iron gate of a slaver's home, and the tribesman checks my manacles, his tan robes swishing softly as he moves around me. I clasp my bandaged hands together to stop them from shaking, but the tribesman gently pries my fingers apart.
"Slavers catch lies the way spiders catch flies," he says. "Your fear is good. It makes your story real. Remember, do not speak."
I nod vigorously. Even if I wanted to say something, I'm too frightened. The slaver is Blackcliff's sole supplier, Keenan had explained while walking me to the tribesman's house. It's taken months for our operative to gain his trust. If he doesn't pick you for the commandant, your mission's dead before it begins. We're escorted through the gates, and moments later, the slaver is circling me, sweating in the heat. He's as tall as the tribesman, but twice as broad, with a paunch that strains the buttons of his gold brocade shirt.
"Not bad,"
the slaver snaps his fingers and a slave girl appears from the recesses of his mansion bearing a tray of drinks. The slaver slurps one down, pointedly not offering anything to the tribesman.
The brothels will pay well for her. As a whore, she won't fetch more than 100 marks, the tribesman says in his hypnotic lilt. I need 200.
The slaver snorts, and I want to strangle him for it. The shaded streets of his neighborhood are littered with sparkling fountains and bow-backed scholar slaves. The man's house is a bloated hodgepodge of arches and columns and courtyards. 200 silvers is a drop in the bucket for him. He probably paid more for the plaster lions flanking his front door.
I hoped to sell her as a house slave, the tribesman continues. I heard you are looking for one. I am, the slaver admits. Commandant's been on my back for days. Hag keeps killing off her girls. Temper like a viper.
The slaver eyes me the way a rancher eyes a heifer, and I hold my breath. Then he shakes his head.
She's too small, too young, too pretty. She won't last a week in Blackcliff, and I don't want the bother of replacing her. I'll give you 100 for her and sell her to Madame Mo over Dockside.
A bead of sweat trickles down the tribesman's otherwise serene face. Mazin ordered him to do whatever it took to get me into Blackcliff. But if he drops his price suddenly, the slaver will be suspicious. If he sells me as a whore, the resistance will have to get me out. And there is no guarantee they can do so quickly. If he doesn't sell me at all, my attempt to save Darin will fail. Do something, Lyra. Darin again, fanning my courage. Or I'm dead. I press clothes well, master. The words are out before I can reconsider. The tribesman's mouth drops open, and the slaver regards me as if I'm a rat who has begun juggling. And, I can cook and clean and dress hair. I trail off into a whisper. I'd make a good maid. The slaver stares me down, and I wish I'd kept my mouth shut. Then his eyes grow shrewd, almost amused.
Afraid of whoring, girl?
Don't
see why. It's an honest enough trade.
He circles me again, then jerks my chin up until I am looking into his reptilian green eyes.
You said you can dress hair and press clothes. Can you barter and handle yourself in the market?
Yes, sir.
You can't read, of course. Can you count?
Of course I can count, and I can read too, you double-chinned pig. Yes, sir. I can count.
She'll have to learn to keep her mouth shut, the slaver says. I've got to eat the cost of clean-up. Can't send her to Blackcliff looking like a chimney sweep.
He considers.
I'll take her for 150 silver marks. I can always take her to one of the Illustrian houses, the tribesman suggests. Underneath all that dirt, she's a fine-looking girl. I'm sure they'd pay well for her.
The slaver narrows his eyes. I wonder if Mazin's man has erred, trying to bargain higher. Come on, you miser, I think at the slaver. Cough up a little extra. The slaver pulls out a sack of coins. I fight to hide my relief.
180 marks, then. Not a copper more. Take off her chains.
Less than an hour later, I'm locked inside a ghost wagon that is heading for Blackcliff. Wide, silver bands that mark me as a slave adorn each wrist. A chain leads from the collar around my neck to a steel rail inside the wagon. My skin still smarts from the scrubbing I got from 2 slave girls, and my head aches from the tight bun they tamed my hair into. My dress, black silk with a corset tight bodice and diamond patterned skirt, is the finest thing I've ever worn. I hate it on sight. The minutes crawl by. The inside of the wagon is so dark that I feel as if I've gone blind. The Empire throws scholar children into these wagons, some as young as 2 or 3, ripped screaming from their parents. After that, who knows what happens to them? The ghost wagons are so named because those who disappear into them are never seen again. Don't think of such things, Darren whispers to me. Focus on the mission and how you'll save me. As I go over Keenan's instructions again in my head, the wagon begins to climb, moving achingly slow. The heat seeps into me, and when I feel as if I'll faint from it, I think up a memory to distract myself. Pop sticking his finger in a fresh jam pot 3 days ago and laughing while Nan whacked him with a spoon. Their absence is a wound in my chest. I miss Pop's growling laugh and Nan's stories. And Darren, how I miss my brother, his jokes and drawings, and how he seems to know everything. Life without him isn't just empty. It's scary. He's been my guide, my protector, my best friend for so long that I don't know what to do without him. The thought of him suffering torments me. Is he in a cell right now? Is he being tortured? In the corner of the ghost wagon, something flickers, dark and creeping. I want it to be an animal, a mouse, or Skies, even a rat. But then the creature's eyes are on me, bright and ravenous. It is one of the things, one of the shadows from the night of the raid. I'm going crazy, bleeding back crazy. I close my eyes, willing the thing to disappear. When it doesn't, I swat at it with trembling hands. Liar. Go away. You're not real. The thing inches close. Don't scream, liar, I tell myself, biting down hard on my lip. Don't scream. Your brother suffers, liar. Each of the creature's words is deliberate, as if it wants to make sure I don't miss a single one. The marshals pull pain from him slowly and with relish. No, you're in my head. The creature's laugh is like breaking glass. I'm real as death, little liar. Real as shattered bones and traitorous sisters and hateful masks. You're an illusion. You're my guilt. I grab Mother's armlet. The shadow flashes its predator's grin, and now it's only a foot away. But then the wagon comes to a stop, and the creature gives me a last malevolent look before disappearing with a dissatisfied hiss. Seconds later, the wagon door swings open, and the forbidding walls of Black Cliff are before me, their oppressive weight driving the hallucination from my mind. Eyes down. The slaver unchains me from the rail, and I force my gaze to the cobbled street. Only speak to the Commandant if she speaks to you. Don't look her in the eyes. She's flogged slaves for less. When she gives you a task, carry it out quickly and well. She'll disfigure you in the first few weeks, but you'll thank her for it eventually. If the scarring's bad enough, it'll keep the older students from raping you too often. The last slave lasted 2 weeks, the slaver continues, oblivious to my growing terror. Commandant wasn't happy about it. My fault, of course. I should have given the girl some fair warning. Went batty when the Commandant branded her, apparently. Threw herself off the cliffs. Don't you do the same. He gives me a hard look, like a father warning an errant child not to wander off. Or the Commandant will think I'm supplying her with inferior goods. The slaver nods a greeting to the guards stationed at the gates and pulls my chain as if I'm a dog. I shuffle after him. Rape. Disfigurement. Branding. I can't do it, Darren. I can't. A visceral urge to flee sweeps through me, so powerful that I slow, stop, pull away from the slaver. My stomach roils, and I think I'll be sick. But the slaver yanks the chain hard and I stumble forward. There's nowhere to run, I realize as we pass beneath Black Cliff's iron-spiked portcullis and into the fabled grounds. There's nowhere to go. There's no other way to save Darren. I'm in now, and there is no going back.
Chapter 12. Elias. Hours after I'm named an aspirant, I dutifully stand beside Grandfather in his cavernous foyer to greet guests arriving for my graduation party. Though Quinn Veturius is 77 years old, women blush when he looks them in the eye, and men wince when he deigns to shake their hands. The lamplight paints his thick mane of white hair gold, and the way he towers over everyone else, the way he nods at those entering his home, makes me imagine a falcon watching the world from an updraft. By eighth bell, the mansion is packed with the finest Illustrian families, along with a few of the wealthiest Mercators. The only plebeians are the stable hands. My mother wasn't invited.
"Congratulations, Aspirant Veturius," a moustached man, who might be a cousin, says as he shakes my hand in both of his, using the title the augurs bestowed on me during graduation.
"Or should I say, Your Imperial Majesty?" The man dares to meet Grandfather's gaze with an obsequious grin. Grandfather ignores him. It's been like this all night. People whose names I don't know are treating me as if I'm their long-lost son or brother or cousin. Half of them probably are related to me, but they've never bothered acknowledging my existence before this. The bootlickers are interspersed with friends: Faris, Dex, Tristus, Leander. But the person I wait most impatiently for is Helene. After I took the oath, the families of the graduates flooded the field, and she was swept away in a tide of Jen's Aquila before I had a chance to speak to her. What is she thinking about the trials? Are we competing against each other for emperorship? Or will we work together, as we have since entering Blackcliff? My questions lead to more questions. Most urgently, how becoming the leader of an empire I loathe can possibly result in my attaining true freedom of body and of soul. One thing is certain. As much as I want to escape Blackcliff, the school isn't done with me yet. Instead of a month of leave, we only get 2 days. Then the augurs have demanded that all students, even graduates, return to Blackcliff to serve as witnesses to the trials. When Helene finally arrives at Grandfather's house, parents and sisters in tow, I forget to greet her. I'm too busy staring. She salutes Grandfather, slender and shining in her ceremonials, her black cloak fluttering lightly. Her hair, silver in the candlelight, pours down her back like a river. "Careful, Aquila," I say as she approaches. "You almost look like a girl."
"And you almost look like an aspirant."
Her smile doesn't reach her eyes, and instantly I know something's off. Her earlier elation has evaporated, and she's jittery, the way she is before a battle she thinks she won't win.
"What's wrong?"
I ask. She tries to get past me, but I take her hand and pull her back. There's a storm in her eyes, but she forces a smile and gently untangles her fingers from mine.
"Nothing's wrong. Where's the food? I'm starving."
"I'll come with you."
"Aspirant Veturius," Grandfather booms. "Governor Leif Tenalius wishes a word."
"Best not keep Quinn waiting," Helene says. "He looks determined."
She slips away, and I grit my teeth as Grandfather coerces me into a stilted discussion with the governor. I repeat the same boring conversation with a dozen other Illustrian leaders over the next hour, until at long last, Grandfather steps away from the unending stream of guests and pulls me aside.
"You're distracted when you can ill afford to be," he says.
These men could be very helpful. Can they take the trials for me?
Don't be an idiot,
Grandfather says in disgust.
An emperor is not an island. It takes thousands to run the empire effectively. The city governors will report to you, but they'll mislead and manipulate you at every step, so you'll need a spy network to keep them in check. The scholars' resistance, border raiders, and the more troublesome of the tribes will see a change in dynasty as an opportunity to sow disorder. You'll need the full support of the military to put down any hint of rebellion. In short, you need these men as advisors, ministers, diplomats, generals, spy masters.
I nod distractedly. There's a Mercator girl in a tantalizingly flimsy dress, eyeing me from the door leading to the crowded garden. She's pretty, really pretty. I smile at her. Maybe after I find Helene. Grandfather grabs my shoulder and steers me away from the garden, which I've been inching toward.
Pay attention, boy, he says. The drums carried news of the trials to the Emperor this morning. My spies tell me he left the capital as soon as he heard. Here, most of his house will be here in a matter of weeks. The Bloodshrike, too, if he wants to keep his head.
At my look of surprise, Grandfather snorts.
Did you think Jen's Tyre would go down without a fight?
But the Emperor practically worships the Augurs. He visits them every year.
Indeed. And now they've turned against him by threatening to usurp his dynasty. He'll fight. You can count on it.
Grandfather narrows his eyes.
If you want to win this, you need to wake up. I've already wasted too much time cleaning up your messes. The Farrar brothers are telling anyone who will listen that you nearly let a deserter escape yesterday, that your mask not joining with you is a sign of disloyalty. You're lucky the Bloodshrike is in the north. He'd have had you in the stocks by now. As it is, the Blackguard chose not to investigate once I reminded them that the Farrars are low-born plebeian scum, and you're from the finest house in the Empire.
Are you listening to me?
Of course I am. I act affronted. But since I'm half eyeing the Mercator girl and half looking into the garden for Helene, Grandfather isn't convinced. I wanted to find Hel...
Don't you dare get distracted by Aquila,
Grandfather says.
How she managed to be named aspirant in the first place, I don't understand. Women have no place in the military.
Aquila's one of the best fighters at the school. At my defense of her, Grandfather slams his hand on an antique entryway table, so hard that a vase falls from it and shatters. The Mercator girl yelps and scurries away. Grandfather doesn't blink.
Rubbish, Grandfather says. Don't tell me you have feelings for the wench.
Grandfather,
she belongs to the Empire, though I suppose if you were named Emperor, you could set her aside as Bloodshrike and marry her instead. She's an Illustrian of strong stock, so at least you'd have a passel of heirs.
Grandfather, stop. I am uncomfortably aware of the heat rising in my neck at the prospect of making heirs with Helene. I don't think of her like that. She's... Grandfather lifts a silver eyebrow as I stammer like a fool. I am full of it, of course. Students don't get much in the way of women at Blackcliff, unless they rape a slave or pay a whore, neither of which I've ever had any interest in. I've had plenty of diversions during leave, but leave comes once a year. Helene is a girl, a pretty girl, and I spend most of my time around her. Of course I've thought of her in that way. But it doesn't mean anything.
She's a comrade in arms, Grandfather, I say. Could you love a fellow soldier the way you loved Grandmother?
None of my fellows were tall blonde girls.
Am I done here? I'd like to celebrate my graduation.
One more thing.
Grandfather disappears, returning a few moments later with a long package wrapped in black silk.
These are for you, he says. I was planning to leave them to you when you became pater of Gens Veturia, but they'll serve you better now.
When I open the package, I nearly drop it.
10 burning hells!
I stare at the sims in my hands, a matched set with intricate black etchings that probably have no equal in the Empire.
These are Telluman's sims.
Made by the current Telluman's grandfather. Good man. Good friend.
Jens Telluman has produced the most talented Empire smiths for centuries. The current Telluman smith spends months fashioning the mask's Serik steel armor every year. But a Telluman sim, a true Telluman sim, able to cut through 5 bodies at once, is forged every few years, at the most.
I can't take these.
I try to give the blades back, but Grandfather plucks my own sims from where I've slung them on my back and replaces them with the Telluman blades.
They are a fitting gift for an emperor, he says. See that you earn them. Always victorious.
Always victorious.
I echo the Veturia motto, and Grandfather leaves to attend to his guests. Still reeling from the gift, I head to the food tent, hoping to find Helene. Every few feet, people stop to chat with me. Someone shoves a plate of spiced kebabs into my hand. Someone else, a drink. A pair of older masks bemoan the fact that the trials didn't take place in their time, while a group of illustrian generals discuss Emperor Tyus in hushed tones, as if his spies might be watching. No one speaks of the augurs with anything less than reverence. No one would dare. When I finally escape the crowd, Helene's nowhere in sight, though I spot her sisters, Hannah and Livia, eyeing a bored-looking Faris.
Veturius,
Faris grunts at me, and I'm relieved that he doesn't treat me with the same fawning awe as everyone else.
I need you to introduce me.
He looks pointedly at a knot of silk-clad, bejeweled illustrian girls, lurking near the edges of the tent, some of whom are watching me in a disturbingly predatory way. I know a few of the girls well. Too well, actually, for all that whispering they're doing to come to any good.
Faris, you're a mask. You don't need an introduction. Just go talk to them.
If you're that nervous, ask Dex or Demetrius to go with you.
Have you seen Helene?
He ignores my question.
Demetrius didn't come, probably because fun is against his moral code. And Dex is drunk, loosening up for once in his life, thank the skies.
What about Trist?
Too busy drooling at his fiancée.
Faris nods to one of the tables, where Trista sits with Aelia, pretty and black-haired. He looks happier than I've seen him all year.
And Leander confessed his love to Helene.
Again?
Again. She told him to piss off before she broke his nose a second time, and he went looking for solace in the back garden with some redhead. You're my last hope.
Faris looks lasciviously at the illustrian girls.
If we remind them that you'll be emperor, I bet we could get 2 each.
Now there's a thought. I actually consider this for a moment before remembering Helene. But I have to find Aquila. At that moment, she walks into the tent and past the knot of girls, stopping when one speaks to her. She glances at me before whispering something. The girl's jaw drops open, and Helene turns back around and leaves the tent.
I've got to catch Helene,
I say to Faris, who has noticed Hannah and Livia, and is smiling invitingly at them while smoothing back his cowlick.
Don't get too drunk, I advise. And unless you want to wake up without your manhood, stay away from those two. They're Hell's little sisters.
The smile drops off Faris's face, and he moves determinedly out of the tent. I hurry after Helene, spotting a flash of blonde heading through Grandfather's vast gardens and toward a rickety shed at the back of the house. The light of the party tent doesn't reach this far, and I have only starlight by which to navigate. I keep my plate, toss my drink, and pull myself atop the shed, one-handed, before clambering onto the sloped roof of the house. You could have picked an easier spot to get to, Aquila.
It's quiet up here,
she says from the darkness.
Plus you can see all the way to the river. Did you bring any for me?
Piss off. You probably had two plates while I shook hands with all those stuffed shirts.
Mother says I'm too skinny.
She spears a pastry off my plate with a dagger.
What took you so long to get up here anyway? Paying court to your bevy of maidens?
My awkward conversation with Grandfather comes sharply to mind, and a thorny silence descends. Helene and I don't discuss girls. She teases Faris and Dex and the others about their dalliances, but not me. Never me.
Would you believe Lavinia Tenalia had the nerve to ask me if you'd ever spoken of her? I about shoved a kebab skewer through that bursting bodice of hers.
The barest frisson of tension tinges Helene's voice, and I clear my throat.
What do you say to her? I told her you called out her name every time you visited the dock girls. Shut her right up.
I burst into laughter, understanding now the horrified look on Lavinia's face. Helene smiles, but her eyes are sad. She seems lonely, suddenly. When I tilt my head to capture her gaze, she looks away. Whatever is wrong, she's not ready to tell me.
What will you do if you become Empress? I ask. What will you change? You're going to win, Elias, and I'll be your Bloodshrike.
She speaks with such conviction that for a second, it's like she's speaking some old truth, like she is telling me the color of the sky. But then she shrugs and looks away.
But if I won, I'd change everything. Expand trade south. Bring women into the army. Open up relations with the mariners. And I'd do something about the scholars.
You mean the resistance?
No. What happens in the quarter? The raids? The killing? It's not...
I know she wants to say that it's not right, but that would be sedition.
Things could be better, she says.
There's a challenge in her face when she looks at me, and I lift my eyebrows. Helene never struck me as a scholar sympathizer. I like her more for it.
What about you? She asks. What would you do?
Same as you, I guess. I can't tell her that I have no interest in ruling and never will. She won't understand.
Maybe I'd just let you run things while I lounged in my harem. Be serious.
I'm very serious. I grin at her.
The Emperor does have a harem, right? Because that's the only reason I took the oath.
She shoves me, practically off the roof, and I beg for mercy.
It's not funny.
She sounds like a centurion, and I try to arrange my face in an appropriately sober manner.
Our lives are on the line here, she says. Promise me you'll fight to win. Promise me you'll give the trials everything you've got.
She grabs a strap on my armor.
Promise! All right, bleeding skies. It was just a joke.
Of course I'll fight to win. I'm not planning to die, that's for sure. But what about you? Don't you want to become Empress? She shakes her head vehemently.
I'm better suited to being Bloodshrike, and I don't want to compete with you, Elias. The moment we start working against each other is the moment we let Marcus and Zack win.
Hell. I think to ask her what's wrong again.
hoping that all this talk of sticking together will make her want to confide in me. She doesn't give me the chance.
Vittorius!
Her eyes widen when she catches sight of the scabbards on my back.
Are those Telemann blades?
I show her the Sims, and she is appropriately envious. We are quiet for a while after, content to contemplate the stars above us, to find music in the distant sounds that drift up from the forges. I take in her slim body, her lean profile. What would Helene have been if not a mask? It's impossible to imagine her as a typical Illustrian girl, angling for a good match, attending fates and allowing herself to be seduced by fittingly high-born men. I guess it doesn't matter. Whatever we might have been, healers or politicians, jurists or builders, was trained out of us, spun up and away into the funnel of darkness that is Blackcliff.
What's going on with you, Hel?
I say. Don't insult me by pretending you don't know what I'm talking about.
I'm just nervous about the trials.
She doesn't pause or stutter. She looks right into my eyes. Her blue irises clear and mild, her head tilted slightly. Anyone else would believe her without question. But I know Helene, and I know instantly, down in my bones, that she's lying. In another flash of insight, born of the awareness that only makes itself known deep in the night, when the mind opens strange doors, I realize something else. This is not a quiet lie. It is violent and shattering. She sighs at my expression.
Leave it alone, Elias.
So there is something.
Fine,
she cuts me off.
I'll tell you what's bothering me if you tell me what you were really doing in the tunnels yesterday morning.
The comment is so unexpected that I have to look away from her. I told you, I...
Yes, you said you were looking for the deserter. And I'm saying there's nothing wrong with me. Now it's all clear and in the open.
There is a bite to her voice I'm not used to.
And there's nothing else to talk about.
She meets my gaze, an unfamiliar wariness in her eyes.
What are you hiding, Elias?
Her expression asks. Hel's a master at ferreting out secrets. Something about the combination of her loyalty and patience creates an uncanny urge to confide. She knows, for instance, that I smuggle sheets to the yearlings so they don't get whipped for wetting their beds. She knows I write to Mamie Reeler and my foster brother, Sean, every month. She knows I once dumped a bucket of cow dung on Marcus's bed. She chuckled for days over that one. But there's so much now that she doesn't know. My loathing of the Empire. How desperately I want to be free of it. We aren't kids anymore, laughing over shared confidences. We never will be again. In the end, I don't answer her question. She doesn't answer mine. Instead, we sit without words, watching the city, the river, the desert beyond, our secrets heavy between us.
Chapter 13 Liar. Despite the slaver's warning to keep my head down, I gaze at the school with sick wonder. Night blends into the grey of the stone until I can't tell where the shadows end and the buildings of Blackcliff begin. Blue fire lamps make even the bare, sand-training fields of the school seem ghostly. In the distance, moonlight glimmers off the columns and arches of a dizzyingly high amphitheater. Blackcliff students are on leave, and the scrape of my sandals is the only sound to break the sinister quiet of the place. Every hedge is squared as if by a plane. Every path is neatly paved without a crack in sight. There are no flowers or blooming vines crawling up the buildings, no benches where students can relax.
Face forward, the slaver barks. Eyes down.
We head for a structure crouching on the lip of the southern cliffs like a black toad. It's built of the same brooding granite as the rest of the school. The Commandant's house. A sea of sand dunes stretches below the cliffs, lifeless and unforgiving. Far beyond the dunes, the blue jags of the Seren Range cut into the horizon. A diminutive slave girl opens the front door of the house. The first thing I notice is her eye patch. She'll disfigure you in the first few weeks, the slaver had said. Will the Commandant take my eye too? Doesn't matter. I reach for my armlet. It's for Darin. All for Darin. The inside of the house is as gloomy as a dungeon, the smattering of candles providing little illumination against the dark stone walls. I look around, glimpsing the simple, almost monkish furnishings of a dining room and sitting room before the slaver grabs a fistful of my hair and pulls on it so hard I think my neck will break. A knife appears in his hand, its tip caressing my eyelashes. The slave girl winces. You look up one more time, the slaver says, his hot breath foul in my face. I'll carve out your eyes. Understand? My eyes water, and at my rapid nod, he releases me. Stop blubbering, he says, as the slave leads us upstairs. Commandant would rather put a sim through you than deal with tears, and I didn't spend 180 marks just to throw your corpse to the vultures. The slave girl leads us to a door at the end of a hallway, straightening her already perfectly pressed black dress before knocking softly. A voice orders us to enter. As the slaver pushes the door open, I get a glimpse of a heavily curtained window, a desk, and a wall of hand-drawn faces. Then I remember the slaver's knife and pin my eyes to the floor. It took you long enough, a soft voice greets us. Forgive me, Commandant, the slaver says. My supplier, silence. The slaver swallows. His hands rasp like a snake's coils as he rubs them together. I stand perfectly still. Is the Commandant looking at me? Examining me? I try to look beaten and obedient, the way I know marshals like scholars to look. A second later, she is before me, and I jump, surprised at how silently she's come around her desk. She's smaller than I expect, shorter than me, and reed slim, almost delicate. If not for the mask, I might mistake her for a child. Her uniform is pressed to perfection, and her pants are tucked into mirror-bright black boots. Every button of her ebony shirt gleams with the shimmer of a serpent's eyes. Look at me, she says. I force myself to obey, instantly paralyzed as I meet her gaze. Looking into her face is like looking at the flat, smooth surface of a gravestone. There isn't a shred of humanity in her grey eyes, nor any evidence of kindness in the planes of her masked features. A spiral of faded blue ink curls up the left side of her neck, a tattoo of some kind. What is your name, girl? Lyra. My head is jerked to one side, my cheek on fire before I even realize she struck me. Tears spring to my eyes at the sharpness of the slap, and I dig my nails into my thigh to keep from running. Wrong, the Commandant informs me. You have no name, no identity. You are a slave. That is all you are. That is all you will ever be. She turns to the slaver to discuss payment. My face is still smarting when the slaver unhooks my collar. Before walking out, he pauses. May I offer you my congratulations, Commandant? On what? On the naming of the aspirants. It's all over the city. Your son, get out, the Commandant says. She turns her back on the startled slaver, who quickly retreats and settles her gaze on me. This thing actually spawned What kind of demon had she whelped? I shudder, hoping I never find out. The silence lengthens, and I remain still as a post, too afraid to even blink. 2 minutes with the Commandant, and she's already cowed me. Slave, she says. Look behind me. I look up, and the peculiar impression of faces I'd gotten when I first walked in resolves itself. The wall behind the Commandant is covered with wood-framed posters of men and women, old and young. There are dozens, row after row. Wanted, rebel spy, scholar thieves, resistance henchmen, reward 250 marks, 1,000 marks. These are the faces of every resistance fighter I've hunted down, every scholar I've jailed and executed. Most before my tenure as commandant, some after. A paper cemetery. The woman is sick. I look away. I will tell you the same thing I tell every slave brought into Blackcliff. The resistance has tried to penetrate this school countless times. I have discovered it every time. If you are working with the resistance, if you contact them, if you think of contacting them, I will know and I will destroy you. Look, I do as she asks, trying to ignore the faces and letting the images and words fade into a blur. But then I see two faces that will not fade. Two faces that, however poorly rendered, I could never ignore. Shock courses through me slowly, as if my body is fighting it, as if I don't want to believe what I see. Mira and John of Sarah, resistance leaders, top priority, dead or alive. Reward, 10,000 marks. Nan and Pop never told me who destroyed my family. A mask, they said. Does it matter which one? And here she is. This is the woman who crushed my parents under her steel-bottomed boot, who brought the resistance to its knees by killing the greatest leaders it ever had. How did she do it? How, when my parents were such masters of concealment that few knew what they looked like, let alone how to find them? The traitor. Someone swore allegiance to the Commandant, someone my parents trusted. Did Mazin know he was sending me into the lair of my parents' murderer? He's a stern man, but he doesn't seem like a willfully cruel one. If you cross me, the Commandant holds my eyes relentlessly. You'll join the faces on that wall. Do you understand? Ripping my gaze from my parents, I nod, trembling in my struggle not to allow my body to betray my shock. My words are a strangled whisper. Understand. Good. She goes to the door and pulls on a cord. Moments later, the one-eyed girl appears to escort me downstairs. The Commandant closes the door behind me, and anger rises in me like a sickness. I want to turn around and attack the woman. I want to scream at her. You killed my mother, who had a lion's heart, and my sister, who laughed like the rain, and my father, who captured truth with a few strokes of a pen. You took them from me. You took them from this world. But I don't turn back. Darren's voice comes to me again. Save me, Thaya. Remember why you're here. To spy. Skies. I didn't notice anything in the Commandant's office except for her wall of death. The next time I go in, I have to pay closer attention. She doesn't know I can read. I might learn something just by glancing at the papers on her desk. My mind occupied, I barely hear the featherlight whisper of the girl as it drifts past my ear. Are you all right? Though she is only a few inches smaller than me, she seems tiny somehow, her stick-thin body swimming in her dress, her face pinched and frightened, like that of a starved mouse. A morbid part of me wants to ask her how she lost her eye. I'm fine, I say. Don't think I got on her good side, though. She doesn't have a good side. That's clear enough. What's your name? I don't have a name, the girl says. None of us do. Her hand strays to her eye patch, and I suddenly feel sick. Is that what happened to this girl? She told someone her name, and she had her eye gouged out. Be careful, she says softly. The Commandant sees things, knows things she shouldn't. The girl hurries ahead of me, as if wishing to physically escape the words she'd just spoken. Come, I was supposed to take you to cook. We make our way to the kitchen, and as soon as I walk in, I feel better. The space is wide, warm, and well-lit, with a giant hearth and stove squatting in one corner and a wooden work table sprawled in the center. The roof drips with strings of shriveled red peppers and paper-skinned onions. A spice-laden shelf runs along one wall, and the scent of lemon and cardamom permeates the air. If not for the largeness of the place, I could be back in Nan's kitchen. A stack of dirty pots rises from a sink, and a kettle of water boils on the stove. Someone has laid out a tray with biscuits and jam. A small, white-haired woman in a diamond-patterned dress, identical to mine, stands at the work table, chopping an onion with her back to us. Beyond her is a screen door that leads outside. Cook, the girl says. This is... kitchen girl. The woman addresses her without turning. Her voice is strange, raspy, as if she's ill. Didn't I ask you to wash those pots hours ago? Kitchen girl doesn't get a chance to protest. Stop your dawdling and get to it, the woman snaps, or you'll be sleeping with an empty belly, and I'll not feel a shred of guilt. When the girl grabs her apron, cook turns from her onion, and I stifle a gasp, trying not to gawp at the ruin of her face. Ropey, vivid red scars run from her forehead down across her cheeks, lips, and chin, all the way into the high neck of her black dress. It looks as though a wild animal clawed her to shreds, and she had the misfortune of surviving. Only her eyes, a dark agate blue, remain whole. Who? She takes me in, standing unnaturally still. Then, without explanation, she turns and limps out the back door. I look at kitchen girl for aid. I didn't mean to stare. Cook? Kitchen girl moves timidly to the door, opening it a crack. Cook? When no response comes, kitchen girl glances between me and the door. The kettle on the stove whistles shrilly. It's nearly ninth bell, she twists her hands together. That's when the Commandant is evening tea. You're to take it up, but if you're late, the Commandant, she'll what? She'll be angry. Terror, true animal terror, fills the girl's face. Right, I say. Kitchen girl's fear is contagious, and I hurriedly pour water from the kettle into the mug on the tray. How does she take it? Sugar? Cream? She takes cream. The girl rushes to a cupboard and pulls out a covered pail, spilling some of the milk. Oh, here. I take the pail from her and spoon out the cream, trying to stay calm. See? All done. I'll just clean up. There's no time. The girl shoves a tray into my arms and pushes me toward the hall. Please, hurry. It's almost... The bells begin to toll. Go, the girl says. Get up there before the last bell. The stairs are steep and I'm walking too fast. The tray lists, and I barely have a chance to grab the cream pot before the teaspoon clatters to the ground. The bell tolls for a ninth time and falls silent. Calm down, liar. This is ridiculous. The Commandant probably won't even notice if I'm 5 seconds late. but she will notice if the tray is in disarray. I balance the tray in one hand and sweep up the spoon, taking a moment to neaten the crockery before approaching the door. It swings open as I raise my hand to knock. The tray is out of my arms, the cup of hot tea sailing past my head and exploding against the wall behind me. I'm still gaping when the commandant pulls me into her office. Turn around! My whole body shakes as I turn to face the closed door. I don't register the zing of wood cutting through the air until the commandant's riding crop slices into my back. The shock of it drops me to my knees. It comes down thrice more before I feel her hands in my hair. I yelp as she brings my face close to hers, the silver of her mask nearly touching my cheeks. I clench my teeth shut against the pain, forcing back tears as I think of the slaver's words. The commandant would rather put a sim in you than deal with tears. I don't tolerate tardiness, she says, her eyes eerily calm. It won't happen again. Yes, commandant. My whisper is no louder than kitchen girls had been. It hurts too much to speak any louder. The woman releases me. Clean up the mess in the hall. Report to me tomorrow morning at 6th bell. The commandant steps around me, and moments later, the front door slams shut. The silverware rattles as I pick up the tray. Only 4 lashes, and I feel as if my skin has been torn open and drenched in salt. Blood drips down the back of my shirt. I want to be logical, practical, the way Pop taught me to be when dealing with injuries. Cut the shirt off, my girl. Clean the wounds with witch hazel and pack them with turmeric. Then bandage them and change the dressings twice a day. But where will I get a new shirt? Witch hazel, how will I bandage the wounds with no one to help me? For Darin. For Darin. For Darin. But what if he's dead? A voice whispers in my head. What if the resistance doesn't find him? What if I'm about to put myself through hell for nothing? No. If I let myself go down that path, I won't make it through the night, let alone survive weeks of spying on the commandant. As I pile shards of ceramic on the tray, I hear a rustle on the landing. I look up, cringing, terrified the commandant has returned. But it's only kitchen girl. She kneels beside me and silently mops up the spilled tea with a cloth. When I thank her, her head jerks up like a startled deer's. She finishes mopping and scurries down the stairs. Back in the empty kitchen, I place the tray in the sink and collapse at the work table, letting my head fall into my hands. I'm too numb for tears. It occurs to me then that the commandant's office door is probably still open, her papers strewn about, visible to anyone with the courage to look. Commandant's gone, liar. Go up there and see what you can find. Darin would do it. He'd see this as the perfect chance to gather information for the resistance. But I'm not Darin. And in this moment, I can't think about the mission or the fact that I'm a spy, not a slave. All I can think about is the throbbing in my back and the blood soaking my shirt. You won't survive, the commandant, Keenan had said. The mission will fail. I lower my head to the table, closing my eyes against the pain. He was right. Skies. He was right.
Part 2. The Trials. Chapter 14. Elias. The rest of leave disappears, and in no time, Grandfather is pelting me with advice as we roll toward Blackcliff in his ebony carriage. He spent half of my leave introducing me to the heads of powerful houses, and the other half railing at me for not solidifying as many alliances as possible.
When I told him I wanted to go visit Helene, he'd gone apoplectic.
"The girl's befuddling your senses," he'd raged. "Can't you spot a siren when you see one?"
I choked back a laugh, remembering this now, imagining Helene's face if she knew she was being referred to as a siren. Part of me feels sorry for Grandfather. He is a legend, a general who has won so many battles that no one counts them anymore. The men in his legions worshipped him, not only for his courage and cunning, but for his uncanny ability to evade death, even when facing appalling odds. But at 77, he's long since ceased leading men into border wars, which probably explains his fixation on the trials. Regardless of his reasoning, his advice is sound. I do need to prepare for the trials, and the best way to do that is to get more information about them. I'd hoped the augurs had, at some point in time, expanded on their original prophecy, perhaps even described what the aspirants should expect. But despite combing through Grandfather's extensive library, I found nothing.
"Damn you! Listen to me!"
Grandfather kicks me with a steel-toed boot, and I grab the seat of the carriage, pain shooting through my leg.
"Have you heard a word I've said?"
"The trials are a test of my mettle. I might not know what's in store, but I must be prepared anyway. I must conquer my weaknesses and exploit competitors' weaknesses. Above all, I must remember that a Veturius is..."
"Always victorious."
We say it together, and Grandfather nods approvingly while I try not to betray my impatience. More battles, more violence. All I want is to escape the Empire. Yet here I am. True freedom of body and soul. That's what I'm fighting for, I remind myself. Not rulership, not power. Freedom.
"I wonder where your mother stands on all this," Grandfather muses.
"She won't favor me, that's for sure."
"No, she won't," Grandfather says. "But she knows you have the best odds of winning. Kerris gains much if she backs the right aspirant, and loses much if she backs the wrong one."
Grandfather looks broodingly out the carriage window.
"I've heard strange rumors about my daughter. Things I might have once laughed at. She'll do everything she can to keep you from winning this. Don't expect anything less."
When we arrive at Blackcliff amid dozens of other carriages, Grandfather crushes my hand in his grip.
"You will not disappoint Jens Veturia," he informs me. "You will not disappoint me."
I wince at his handshake, wondering if my own will ever be as intimidating. Helene finds me after Grandfather drives away.
"Since everyone's back to witness the trials, there won't be a new crop of yearlings until the contest is over."
She waves to Demetrius, emerging from his father's carriage a few yards away.
"We're still in our old barracks, and we'll keep the same class schedule as before, except instead of rhetoric and history, we have extra watches on the wall,
even though we're full masks."
"I don't make the rules," Helene says. "Come on, we're late for sim training."
We push through the throng of students toward Blackcliff's front gate.
"Did you find anything on the trials?"
I ask Hel. Someone taps my shoulder, but I ignore them. Probably an earnest cadet trying to make class on time.
"Nothing," Hel says. "Stayed up all night in Father's library, too."
"Same here." "Damn. Peter Aquilus is a jurist, and his library is filled with everything from obscure law books to ancient scholar tomes on mathematics. Between him and Grandfather, we have most relevant books in the Empire covered. There's nowhere else to search."
"We should check the..."
"What, damn it?"
The tapping grows insistent, and I turn, intending to tell off the cadet.
Instead, I'm faced with a slave girl looking up at me through impossibly long eyelashes. A heated, visceral shock flares through me at the clarity of her dark gold eyes. For a second, I forget my name. I've never seen her before, because if I had, I'd remember. Despite the heavy silver cuffs and high, painful-looking bun that mark all of Blackcliff's drudges, nothing about her says slave. Her black dress fits her like a glove, sliding over every curve in a way that makes more than one head turn. Her full lips and fine, straight nose would be the envy of most girls, scholar or not. I stare at her, realize I'm staring, tell myself to stop staring, and then keep staring. My breath falters, and my body, traitor that it is, tugs me forward until there are only inches between us.
Aspirant Veturius.
It's the way she says my name, like it's something to fear, that brings me back to myself. Pull it together, Veturius. I step away, appalled at myself when I see the terror in her eyes. What is it? I ask calmly.
The Commandant has requested you and Aspirant Aquila to report to her office at Sixth Bell.
Sixth Bell? Aline shoves past the gate guards toward the Commandant's house, apologizing to a group of yearlings when she knocks two of them over.
We're late. Why didn't you summon us sooner?
The girl trails us, too frightened to get closer.
There were so many people. I couldn't find you.
Aline waves off the girl's explanation.
She's going to kill us. It must be about the trials, Elias. Maybe the augurs told her something.
Aline hurries ahead, clearly still hoping to make it to my mother's office on time.
Are the trials starting?
The girl claps her hands over her mouth.
I'm sorry,
she whispers.
I...
It's all right. I don't smile at her. It will only scare her. For a female slave, a smile from a mask is not usually a good thing. I am actually wondering the same thing. What's your name?
Slave girl.
Of course. My mother would already have scourged her name out of existence. Right. You work for the Commandant. I want her to say no. I want her to say that my mother roped her into this. I want her to say she's assigned to the kitchens or the infirmary, where slaves aren't scarred or missing body parts. But the girl nods in response to my question. Don't let my mother break you, I think. The girl meets my eyes, and there is that feeling again, low and hot and consuming. Don't be weak. Fight. Escape. A gust of wind whips a strand free from her bun and across her cheekbone. Defiance flashes across her face as she holds my gaze, and for a second, I see my own desire for freedom mirrored, intensified in her eyes. It's something I've never detected in the eyes of a fellow student, let alone a scholar slave. For one strange moment, I feel less alone. But then she looks down, and I wonder at my own naivete. She can't fight. She can't escape. Not from Blackcliff. I smile joylessly. In this, at least, the slave and I are more similar than she'll ever know. When did you start here? I ask her.
3 days ago, sir. Aspirant,
She wrings her hands. Veturius is fine. She walks carefully, gingerly. The Commandant must have whipped her recently, and yet she doesn't hunch or shuffle like the other slaves. The straight-backed grace with which she moves tells her story better than words. She'd been a free woman before this. I'd bet my Sims on it, and she has no idea how pretty she is, or what kind of problems her beauty will cause for her at a place like Blackcliff. The wind pulls at her hair again, and I catch her scent, like fruit and sugar. Can I give you some advice?
Her head flies up like a scared animal's. At least she's wary. Right now, you will grab the attention of every male in a square mile. Stand out, I finish. It's hot, but you should wear a hood or a cloak, something to help you blend in. She nods, but her eyes are suspicious. She wraps her arms around herself and drops back a little. I don't speak to her again. When we arrive at my mother's office, Marcus and Zack are already seated, clad in full battle armor. They fall silent as we enter, and it's obvious they've been talking about us. The Commandant ignores Helene and me and turns from her window, where she's been staring out at the dunes. She motions the slave girl close, then backhands her so hard that blood flies from her mouth.
I said sixth bell.
Anger floods me, and the Commandant senses it.
Yes, Veturius?
Her lips purse, and she tilts her head as if to say,
Do you wish to interfere and bring my wrath down upon yourself?
Helene elbows me, and, fuming, I keep quiet.
Get out!
Mother says to the trembling girl.
Aquila, Veturius, sit.
Marcus watches the slave as she leaves. The lust on his face makes me want to push the girl out of the room faster, while gouging the snake's eyes out. Zack, meanwhile, ignores the girl and glances surreptitiously at Helene. His angular face is pale, and purple shadows darken his eyes. I wonder how he and Marcus spent their leave, helping their plebeian father with his smithing, visiting family, plotting ways to kill me and Helene.
The augurs are otherwise occupied.
A strange, smug smile creeps onto the Commandant's face.
And have asked that in their stead, I give you the details of the trials. Here.
The Commandant slides a piece of parchment across her desk, and we all lean forward to read it.
Four they are, and four traits we seek. Courage to face their darkest fears, cunning to outwit their foes, strength of arms and mind and heart, loyalty to break the soul. It is a foretelling. You'll learn its meaning in the coming days.
The Commandant faces her window again, her hands behind her back. I watch her reflection, unnerved at the self-satisfaction oozing off her.
The augurs will plan and judge the trials, but since this contest is meant to weed out the weak, I have proposed to our holy men that you remain at Blackcliff for the duration of the trial. The augurs agreed.
I stifle a snort. Of course the augurs agreed. They know this place is hell, and they'll want the trials to be as difficult as possible.
I have ordered the centurions to intensify your training to reflect your status as aspirants. I have no say in your conduct during the competition. However, outside the trials, you are still subject to my rules, my punishments.
She begins to pace her office, and her eyes stab into me, warning of whippings and worse.
If you win a trial, you will receive a token from the augurs, a prize of sorts. If you pass a trial but do not win, your reward is your life. If you fail a trial, you will be executed.
She lets that pleasant fact sink in for a moment before going on.
The aspirant who wins two trials first will be named victor. Whoever comes in second with one win will be named Bloodshrike. The others will die. There will be no tie. The augurs wish me to stress that while the trials are taking place, the accepted rules of sportsmanship apply. You will not engage in cheating, sabotage, or chicanery.
I glance at Marcus. Telling him not to cheat is like telling him not to breathe.
What about Emperor Tyus? Marcus says,
The Bloodshrike. The Black Guard. Jen's Tyre isn't just going to disappear. Tyus will retaliate.
The Commandant passes behind me, and my neck prickles unpleasantly.
He has left Antium with his gens, and is heading south to disrupt the trials. But the Augurs shared another foretelling. Waiting vines circle and strangle the oak. The way is made clear just before the end.
What's that supposed to mean? Marcus asks.
It means that the Emperor's actions are not our concern. As for the Bloodshrike and Black Guard, their loyalty lies with the Empire, not Tyus. They will be the first to pledge themselves to the new dynasty. When do the trials begin?
Helene asks.
They may commence at any time.
My mother finally sits and steeples her fingers, her expression remote.
And they may take any form. From the moment you leave this office, you must be prepared.
If they can take any form,
Zack speaks up for the first time,
then how are we supposed to prepare? How will we know they've begun?
You'll know,
the Commandant says.
But
you'll know.
She stares directly at Zack, and he falls silent.
Any other questions?
The Commandant doesn't wait for a response.
Dismissed!
We salute and file out. Not wanting to turn my back on the snake and the toad, I let them go ahead of me, but immediately regret it. The slave girl stands in the shadows near the stairs, and as Marcus passes her, he reaches out and yanks her close. She writhes in his grasp, trying to break his iron grip on her throat. He leans down and murmurs something to her. I reach for my sim, but Helene grabs my arm.
Commandant,
she warns me. Behind us, my mother watches from her study door, arms crossed.
It's her slave,
Helene whispers.
You'd be a fool to interfere.
Aren't you going to stop him?
I turn to the Commandant, keeping my voice low.
She's a slave,
the Commandant says, as if that explains everything.
She's to receive 10 lashes for her incompetence. If you're intent on helping her, perhaps you wish to take on her punishment.
Of course not, Commandant.
Helene digs her nails into my arm and speaks for me, knowing that I'm on the verge of earning myself a whipping. She nudges me down the hall.
Leave it,
she says.
It's not worth it.
She doesn't need to explain. The Empire doesn't chance the loyalty of its masks. The Black Guard will be all over me if they hear I've taken a whipping for a scholar drudge. Ahead of me, Marcus laughs and releases the girl, then follows Zack down the stairs. The girl gulps down air, bruises blooming on her neck.
Help her, Elias.
But I can't. Hell is right. The risk of punishment is too great. Helene strides down the hall, giving me a pointed look.
Move.
The girl pulls her feet back as we pass, trying to make herself small. Disgusted with myself, I spare her no more attention than I would a heap of trash. I feel heartless as I leave her there to face Mother's punishment. I feel like a mask. That night, my dreams are travels, filled with hisses and whispers. Wind circles my head like a vulture, and I flinch from hands burning with unnatural heat. I try to wake as discomfort turns into nightmare, but I only slip deeper in, until eventually there is nothing but choking, burning light. When I open my eyes, the first thing I notice is the hard, sandy ground beneath me. The second is that the ground is hot, skin shriveling hot. My hand shakes as I shield my eyes from the sun and scan the wasted landscape around me. A lone, gnarled jack tree rises from the cracked land a few feet away. Miles to the west,
A vast body of water lays shimmering like a mirage. The air reeks something horrible. A combination of carrion, rotting eggs, and cadets' quarters in high summer. The land is so pale and desolate that I might be standing on a distant, dead moon. My muscles ache, as if I've been lying in the same position for hours. The pain tells me that this is no dream. I stagger to my feet, a lonely silhouette in a vast emptiness. The trials, it seems, have begun.
Chapter 15. Liar. Dawn is still a blue rumor on the horizon when I limp into the Commandant's chambers. She sits at her dressing table, observing her reflection in the mirror. Her bed looks untouched, as it does every morning. I wonder when she sleeps, if she sleeps. She's clad in a loose black robe that softens the disdain on her masked face. It's the first time I've seen her out of uniform. The robe slips down her shoulder, and the unusual swirls of her tattoo are revealed to be part of an ornate A, the dark ink vivid against the chill paleness of her skin. 10 days have passed since my mission began, and while I haven't learned anything that will help me save Darin, I have learned how to press a black cliff uniform in 5 minutes flat, how to carry a heavy tray up the stairs with half a dozen welts on my back, and how to remain so silent that I forget my own existence. Keenan gave me only the barest details about this mission. I'm to gather information about the trials, and then, when I leave Blackcliff for my errands, the Resistance will contact me. Might take us 3 days, Keenan said, or 10. Be prepared to report every time you go into the city and never come looking for us. At the time, I'd suppress the urge to ask him a dozen questions, like how to get the information they want, like how to keep the Commandant from catching me. Now I'm paying for it. Now I don't want the Resistance to find me. I don't want them to learn what a terrible spy I am. At the back of my mind, Darin's voice grows fainter. Find something, liar. Something that will save me. Hurry. No. Another louder part of me says, lay low. Don't risk spying until you're certain you won't get caught. Which voice do I listen to? The spy or the slave? The fighter or the coward? I thought the answers to such questions would be easy. That was before I learned what real fear was. For now, I move around the Commandant quietly, setting down her breakfast tray, clearing her tea from the night before, laying out her uniform. Don't look at me. Don't look at me. My pleas seem to work. The Commandant acts as if I don't exist. When I open the curtains, the first rays of morning illuminate the room. I stop to look at the emptiness beyond the Commandant's window, miles of whispering dunes rippling like waves in the dawn wind. For a second, I lose myself in their beauty. Then Blackcliff's drums thud out, a wake-up call for the entire school and half the city. Slave girl! The Commandant's impatience has me moving before she says another word. My hair! As I take a brush and pins from a table drawer, I catch a glimpse of myself in the mirror. The bruises from my run-in with Aspirant Marcus a week ago are fading, and the 10 lashes I received afterward had scabbed over. Other wounds have replaced them. 3 lashes on my legs for a dust stain on my skirt, 4 lashes on my wrists for not finishing her mending, a black eye from a skull in a foul mood. The Commandant opens a letter sitting on her dressing table. She keeps her head still as I pull back her hair, ignoring me entirely. For a second, I stand frozen, staring down at the parchment as she reads. She doesn't notice. Of course she doesn't. Scholars don't read, or so she assumes. I brush out her pale hair swiftly. Look at it, liar, Darin's voice. Discover what it says. She will see. She will punish me,
She doesn't know you can read. She'll think you're an idiot scholar gawping at pretty symbols. I swallow. I should look. 10 days at Blackcliff, with nothing to show for it but bruises and lashes, is disastrous. When the Resistance demands a report, I won't have anything for them. What will happen to Darin then? Again and again, I glance at the mirror to make sure the Commandant is enmeshed in her letter. When I'm sure, I risk a quick look down. Too dangerous in the South, and the Commandant is not trustworthy. I advise that you return to Antium. If you must come south, travel with a small force. The Commandant shifts, and I tear my eyes away, paranoid that I've been too obvious. But she reads on, and I risk another glance. By then, she's turned the parchment over. Allies are deserting Jen's Tyre like rats fleeing a fire. I have learned that the Commandant is planning, but I do not find out what the Commandant is planning, for at that moment I look up. She's watching me, in the mirror. The marks are beautiful, I say in a choked whisper, dropping one of the hairpins. I bend to retrieve it, taking those precious seconds to hide my panic. I'll be whipped for reading something that doesn't even make any sense. Why did I let her see me? Why wasn't I more careful? I haven't seen much of words, I add. No. The woman's eyes flicker, and for a moment I think she's mocking me. Your kind doesn't need to read. She examines her hair. The right side's too low. Fix it. Though I feel like crying from relief, I keep my face carefully bland and slide another pin into her silken hair. How long have you been here, slave? 10 days, sir. Have you made any friends? This question is so preposterous coming from the Commandant that I almost laugh. Friends? At Blackcliff? Kitchen girl is too shy to talk to me, and cook only speaks to give me orders. The rest of Blackcliff's slaves live and work on the main grounds. They are silent and distant, always alone, always wary. You're here for life, girl, the Commandant says, inspecting her now finished hair. Maybe you should get to know your fellows. Here. She hands me 2 sealed letters. Take the one with the red seal to the courier's office, and the one with the black seal to Spiro Tullaman. Don't leave him without a reply. Who Spiro Tullaman is and how to find him, I don't dare to ask. The Commandant punishes questions with pain. I take the letters and back out of the room to avoid any surprise attacks. A breath explodes out of me when I close the door. Thank the skies, the woman is too arrogant to think her scholar, Drudge, can read. As I walk down the hall, I peek at the first letter and nearly drop it. It's addressed to Emperor Tyus. What would she be corresponding with Tyus about? The trials? I run an experimental finger near the seal. Still soft, it lifts cleanly. There's a scrape behind me, and the letter falls from my hand as I whip around. My mind screams, Commandant. But the hall is empty. I pick up the letter and shove it into my pocket. It seems alive, like a snake or spider I've decided to keep as a pet. I touch the seal again before jerking my hand away. Too dangerous. But I need something to give the Resistance. Every day when I leave Blackcliff to run the Commandant's errands, I fear Keenan will pull me aside and demand a report. Every day he doesn't, it's a reprieve. Eventually, I'll run out of time. I have to get my cloak, so I head to the servants' quarters in the open-air hallway just outside the kitchen. My room, like kitchen girls and cooks, is a dank hole with a low entrance and a ragged curtain that serves as a door. Inside, it's just wide enough to fit a rope pallet and a crate that serves as a side table. From here, I can hear the low tones of cook and kitchen girl speaking. Kitchen girl, at least, has been slightly friendlier than cook. She's helped me with my duties more than once, and at the end of my first day, when I thought I'd faint from the pain of the lashes I'd received, I saw her scuttle away from my quarters. When I went in, I found a healing salve and a mug of pain-numbing tea. That's as far as her friendship extends. I've asked her and cook questions, discussed the weather, complained about the commandant. No response. I'm fairly certain that if I walked into the kitchen stark naked and squawking like a chicken, I still wouldn't get a word out of them. I don't want to approach them again, only to hit a wall of silence. But I need someone to tell me who Spiro Tulliman is, and how to find him. I enter the kitchen to find them both sweating from the heat of the blazing hearth. Lunch is baking already, my mouth waters, and I long for Nan's food. We never had much, but whatever we did have was made with love, which I now know transforms simple fare into a feast. Here, we eat the commandant's scraps, and no matter how hungry I am, they taste like sawdust. Kitchen girl gives me a glance in greeting, and cook ignores me. The older woman perches on a rickety step stool to reach a string of garlic. She looks like she's about to fall, but when I offer a hand to brace her, she glares daggers at me. I drop my hand and stand there awkwardly for a moment. Can you tell me where to find Spiro Tulliman? Silence. Look, I say, I know I'm new, but the commandant told me to make friends. I thought... Ever so slowly, cook turns to me. Her face is grey, as if she might be ill. Friends. It's the first word she's said to me that isn't an order. The old woman shakes her head and takes her garlic to the counter. The anger in her strokes as she chops it is unmistakable. I don't know what I've done that's so terrible, but she won't help me now. I sigh and leave the kitchen. I'll have to ask someone else about Spiro Tulliman. He's a swordsmith, I hear a soft voice say. Kitchen girl has followed me out. She looks over her shoulder, worried cook will hear her. You'll find him along the river, in the weapons quarter. She quickly turns, ready to walk away, and it's this more than anything else that makes me speak to her. I haven't had a conversation with a normal person in 10 days. I'd barely said anything other than yes, sir, and no, sir. I'm Lyra, kitchen girl, freezes. Lyra. She turns the word over in her mouth. I'm Izzy. For the first time since the raid, I smile. I'd nearly forgotten the sound of my own name. Izzy looks up toward the commandant's room. The commandant wants you to make friends so she can use them against you, she whispers. That's why cook is upset. I shake my head. I don't understand. It's how she controls us. Izzy fingers her eye patch. It's the reason cook does whatever she asks. The reason why every slave in Blackcliff does what she asks. If you do something wrong, she won't always punish you. Sometimes she'll punish the people you care about instead. Izzy's so quiet I have to lean forward to hear her. If you want to have friends, make sure she doesn't know. Make sure it's secret. She slips back into the kitchen, quick as a cat in the night. I leave for the courier's office, but I can't stop thinking about what she's told me. If the commandant is sick enough to use the slaves' friendships against them, then it's no wonder Izzy and cook keep their distance. Is that how Izzy lost her eye? Is that how cook got her scars? The commandant hasn't punished me in any permanent way, yet. But it's only a matter of time. The Emperor's letter in my pocket seems suddenly heavier, and I close my hand over it. Do I dare? The faster I get information, the faster the resistance can save Darin, and the faster I can leave Blackcliff. I debate with myself all the way to the school's gates. When I approach, the leather-armored oxes, who usually delight in tormenting slaves, barely notice me. They're intent on two horsemen making their way up to the school. I use the distraction to slip quietly past. Though it's still early morning, the desert heat has set in, and I fidget under the itchy weight of the cloak I've taken to wearing. Every time I put it on, I think of Aspirant Veturius, of that unabashed fire that burned in him when he first turned to me, of his smell when he stepped close, distractingly clean and masculine. I think of his words, spoken almost thoughtfully. Can I give you some advice? I don't know what I expected of the Commandant's son. Someone like Marcus Farrar, who left me with a collar of bruises that ached for days. Someone like Helene Aquila, who spoke to me as if I was less than dirt. At the very least, I thought he'd look like his mother, blonde and wan and cold to the bone. But he is black-haired and gold-skinned, and though his eyes are the same pale grey as the Commandant's, there is no trace there of the gimlet flatness that defines most masks. Instead, when he'd met my gaze for a jolting moment, I'd seen life bursting through, chaotic and alluring beneath the shadow of the mask. I'd seen fire and desire, and my heart had thumped faster. And his mask, so strange that it sits atop his face like a thing apart. Is it a sign of weakness? It can't be. I keep hearing he's Blackcliff's finest soldier. Stop, liar. Stop thinking of him. If he's thoughtful, then there's devilry behind it. If there's fire in his eyes, it's a lust for violence. He's a mask. They're all the same. I wind my way down from Blackcliff, out of the Illustrian Quarter, and into Execution Square, home to the city's largest open-air market, as well as one of only two couriers' offices. The gallows that give the square its name sit empty. But then, the day's just begun. Darren once drew the Execution Square gallows, complete with bodies hanging from the gibbet. Nan saw the image and shuddered. "Burn it," she'd said. Darren nodded. But later that night, I caught him working on it in our room. "It's a reminder, liar," he'd said in his quiet way. "It would be wrong to destroy it." The crowds move through the square sluggishly, wilted by the heat. I have to push an elbow to make any headway, eliciting grumbles from irritated merchants and a shove from a hatchet-faced slaver. As I dart under a palanquin marked with the symbol of an Illustrian house, I spot the courier's office a dozen yards away. I slow, my fingers straying toward the letter to the Emperor. Once I hand it over, there's no getting it back. "Bags, purses and satchels, silk stitched!" I need to open the note. I need to have something for the resistance. But where can I do it without anyone noticing? Behind one of the stalls? In the shadows between two tents? "We use the finest leather and hardware." The seal will lift cleanly enough. But I can't be jostled. If the letter tears or the seal is smudged, the Commandant will probably cut off my hand or my head. "Bags, purses, and satchels, silk stitched." The bag seller is right behind me, and I've a mind to tell him off. Then I smell cedarwood and glance over my shoulder to see a shirtless scholar man, his muscled torso tanned and sweating. His hair, flaming red, glows below a black cap. Shock and recognition jolt my stomach. It's Keenan. His brown eyes meet mine, and as he continues to yell out his wares, he tilts his head ever so slightly toward a side alley leading out of the square. My hands sweat in uneasy anticipation, and I make my way to the alley. What will I say to him? I have nothing, no leads, no information. Keenan doubted me from the beginning, and I am about to prove him right. Dust-coated brick houses rise four stories on either side of the alley, and the noises of the market fade. Keenan is nowhere to be seen, but a woman, draped in rags, detaches herself from a wall and approaches me. I eye her warily until she lifts her head. Through the filthy tangle of dark hair, I recognize Sana. "Follow," she mouths. I want to ask her about Darin, but she's already hurrying away. She leads me through alley after alley, not stopping until we're close to Cobbler Row, nearly a mile from Execution Square. The air is dense with the chattering of shoemakers and the gamey scents of leather and tannin and dye. I think we're going to enter the row, but Sana turns instead into the narrow space between two buildings. She heads down a set of basement stairs so grimy that they look like the inside of a chimney. Keenan opens the door at the base of the stairs before Sana can knock. He's replaced the leather bags with the black shirt and brace of knives he was wearing the first time I met him. A lock of red hair falls into his face, and he looks me over, his gaze lingering on my bruises. "Thought she might have a tail," Sana says as she pulls off the cloak and wig. "But she didn't." "Mazin's waiting." Keenan puts a hand on my back to nudge me forward into the narrow hallway. I wince and recoil. My lashes are still painful. His eyes cut sharply to me, and I think he's going to say something, but instead he drops his hand awkwardly, brow slightly furrowed, and leads us down the hallway and through a door. Mazin sits at a table in the room beyond, his scarred face lit by a lone candle.
"Well, liar,"
he lifts his grey eyebrows.
"What do you have for me?"
"Can you tell me about Darin first?" I ask, finally able to voice the question that has plagued me for a week and a half. "Is he all right?"
"Your brother's alive, liar."
A sigh gusts out of me, and I feel like I can breathe again.
"But I can't tell you any more until you tell me what you have. We did make a deal."
"Let her at least sit." Sana pulls out a chair for me, and almost before I'm in it, Mazin leans forward.
"We have little time," he says. "Whatever you've got, we need."
"The trial started about a week ago." I scramble to connect the few scraps of information I do have. I'm not ready to give him the letter, not yet. If he breaks a seal or tears it, I'm done for. "That's when the aspirants disappeared. There are four of them. Their names..."
"We know all that."
Mazin dismisses my words with the wave of a hand.
"Where were they taken? When does the trial end? What's the next one?" "We've heard that two of the aspirants returned today," Keenan says. "Not long ago, in fact. Maybe half an hour."
I think of the guards talking excitedly at Blackcliff's gate as two horsemen came up the road. Liar, you fool. If I'd paid closer attention to the ox's gossip, I might have learned which aspirants had survived the trial. I might have had something useful to tell Mazin. "I don't know. It's been so hard," I say. Even as I speak, I hear how pathetic I sound and hate myself for it. "The Commandant killed my parents. She has this wall with posters of every rebel she's caught. My parents were up there. Their faces..." Sana's eyes widen, and even Keenan looks slightly sick, his aloofness falling away for a moment. I wonder why I'm telling Mazin this. Perhaps because some part of me wonders if he knew the Commandant killed my parents. If he knew and sent me to Blackcliff anyway.
"I didn't know," Mazin says, sensing my unasked question. "But it's all the more reason that this mission must succeed."
"I want to succeed more than anyone, but I can't get into her office. She never has visitors, so I can't eavesdrop on her." Mazin holds up a hand to stop me.
"What do you know, exactly?"
For one frantic moment, I consider lying. I've read 100 tales of heroes and the trials they face. What harm if I invent one and pass it off as truth? But I can't bring myself to do it. Not when the Resistance is placing their trust in me. Nothing. I stare at the floor, ashamed at the incredulity on Mazin's face. I reach for the letter, but don't pull it out. Too risky. Maybe he'll give you another chance, liar. Maybe you can try again.
What exactly have you been doing all this time?
Surviving, from the looks of it, Keenan says. His dark eyes flash to mine, and I can't tell if he's defending or insulting me.
I was loyal to the Lioness, Mazin says. But I can't waste my time helping someone who won't help me.
Mazin, for Sky's sake, Sunna sounds aghast. Look at the poor girl.
Yes, Mazin eyes the bruises on my neck. Look at her. She's a mess. The mission's too difficult. I made a mistake, liar. I thought you'd take risks. I thought you were more like your mother.
The insult levels me faster than a blow from the Commandant. Of course he's right. I'm nothing like my mother. She'd have never been in this position to begin with.
We'll see about getting you out. Mazin shrugs and stands. We're done here.
Wait! Mazin can't abandon me now. Darin is lost if he does. Reluctantly, I take out the Commandant's letter. I have this. It's from the Commandant to the Emperor. I thought you could look at it.
Why didn't you say that to begin with?
He takes the envelope, and I want to tell him to be careful. But Sunna beats me to it, and Mazin gives her a brief, annoyed look before gently lifting the seal. Seconds later, my heart sinks again. Mazin tosses the letter to the table.
Useless, he says. Look.
Your Imperial Majesty, I will make the arrangements. Ever your servant, Commandant Keris Veturia. Don't give up on me, I say when Mazin shakes his head in disgust. Darin doesn't have anyone else. You were close to my parents. Think of them, please. They wouldn't want their only son to die because you refused to help.
I'm trying to help.
Mazin is unrelenting, and something about the set of his shoulders and the iron in his eyes reminds me of my mother. I understand now why he's leader of the resistance.
But you have to help me. This rescue mission will cost more than just lives. We'll be putting the resistance itself on the line. If our fighters are caught, we risk them giving up information under interrogation. I'm gambling everything to help you, liar.
He crosses his arms.
Make it worth my while.
I will. I promise I will. One more chance. He stares stonily at me for a moment longer before looking to Sunna, who nods, and Keenan, who offers a shrug that could mean any number of things.
One chance, Mazin says. Fail me again, and we're done. Keenan, see her out.
Chapter 16. Elias. 7 days earlier. The Great Wastes. That's where the augurs have left me, in this salt-white flatness that stretches for hundreds of miles, marked by nothing but angry black cracks and the occasional gnarled jack-tree. The pale outline of the moon sits above me like something forgotten. It's more than half full, as it had been yesterday, which means that somehow the augurs have moved me 300 miles from Serra in one night. At this time yesterday, I was in Grandfather's carriage, on my way to Blackcliff. My dagger is driven through a limp piece of parchment and into the scorched ground beside the tree. I tuck the weapon into my belt. It's the difference between life and death out here. The parchment is written in an unfamiliar hand. The Trial of Courage, the Bell Tower, sunset on the 7th day. That's clear enough. If today counts as the first day, I have 6 full days to reach the Bell Tower, or the augurs will kill me for failing the trial. The air's so dry that breathing burns my nostrils. I lick my lips, already thirsty, and hunch beneath the paltry shade of the jack tree to consider my predicament.
The stink in the air tells me that the glittering patch of blue to the west of me is Lake Vitan. Its sulphurous stench is legendary, and it's the only source of water in this wasteland. It's also pure salt, and so completely useless to me. In any case, my path lies east through the Seren mountain range. 2 days to get to the mountains, 2 more to get to Walker's Gap, the only way through. 1 day to get through the gap, and 1 day to get down to Serra. 6 full days exactly, if everything goes as planned. It's too easy. I think back to the foretelling I read in the Commandant's office. Courage to face their darkest fears. Some people might fear the desert. I'm not one of them. Which means there's something else out here. Something that hasn't revealed itself. I tear strips of cloth off my shirt and wrap my feet. I have only what I fell asleep with, my fatigues and my dagger. I'm suddenly, fervently grateful that I was too exhausted from combat training to strip before sleeping. Traveling the Great Wastes naked, that would be its own special sort of hell. Soon the sun sinks into the wild sky of the west, and I stand in the rapidly cooling air. Time to run. I set out at a steady jog, my eyes roving ahead. After a mile, a breeze meanders past, and for a second, I think I smell smoke and death. The smell fades, but it leaves me uneasy. What are my fears? I rack my brain, but I can't think of anything. Most of Blackcliff students fear something, though never for long. When we were yearlings, the Commandant ordered Helene to rappel down the cliffs again and again until she could drop with nothing but a clenched jaw to betray her terror. That same year, the Commandant forced Faris to keep a bird-eating desert tarantula as a pet, telling him that if the spider died, he would too. There must be something I fear. Enclosed spaces? The dark? If I don't know my fears, I won't be prepared for them. Midnight comes and goes, and still the desert around me is quiet and empty. I've traveled nearly 20 miles, and my throat is dry as dirt. I lick at the sweat on my arms, knowing that my need for salt will be as great as my need for water. The moisture helps, but only for a moment. I force myself to focus on the ache in my feet and legs. Pain I can handle, but thirst can drive a man insane. Soon after, I crest a rise and spot something strange ahead. Glimmers of light, like moonlight shining down on a lake. Only there's no lake around here. Dagger in hand, I slow to a walk. Then I hear it. A voice. It starts quietly enough, a whisper I can pass off as the wind, a scrape that sounds like the echo of my footsteps on the cracked ground. But the voice gets closer, clearer.
Elias! Elias!
A low hill rises before me, and I reach the top. The night breeze curdles, bringing with it the unmistakable smells of war.